ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You know, some things are a mess and you're just like, that mutant's not going to make it. You got to put it in a glass case. And there's some other ones where you're just like, okay, you might win the dog show.
Hearing TV on the radio talk about music is as fun as it sounds. When the New York band first emerged, they were like nothing we'd heard before. A mash of genres and sounds, and for many, the sound of tomorrow, today. 10 years on from their last album, the band are back on the road again. And on their first visit to Australia in a decade, they joined me to Take Five. It's the only interview they gave while here, and they really went in on the theme of future sounds from the past. Want to dig into the brains of Tunde Adepimpe, Kip Malone and Jaleel Bunton? You're about to fall into an absolute wormhole. They seem to be in a good spot too, reuniting to play shows all over the world and visit many of the places they made connections with more than 20 years ago when they first began. So what's that like to come back to your old haunts in 2025?
It's awful. No, it's been great. It's been great to do it again. It feels really good, and it's really heartwarming to see that people show up and care. And you run into a lot of folks that you remember from touring, and then you kind of have this double take where you're like, wow, you kind of look like this person's mom. And you're like, oh, no, that's you. It's 15 years ago.
And these audience members or people on the crew?
These are audience members. These are folks we've run into.
It's the mirror every morning.
Yeah, it's the mirror absolutely every morning.
I'm curious about how they take that as well. You just basically saying, wow, you look a lot older.
Oh, no, I just keep it. I keep that to myself. Hopefully it's not apparent on my face. And I'm like, God, what have you been doing?
But also, like, what a privilege to age with your audience and to see them come back after all these years away and to still be turning up to your shows. That's got to be a buzz, right?
Absolutely.
It's really humbling in a way that I wasn't prepared for.
Yeah.
Tremendous gratitude in all sincerity. All your dreams are over now,
and all your wings have fallen down. Well, last year you marked the 20th anniversary of your first big record, and I'm wondering if, like, when you got back together to mark that and to start playing shows, did it give you pause to reflect back on the last two decades of adventuring with one another? Are you the kind of band that look back and reminisce and think about those nostalgic times?
You know, it comes with the experience of playing music that was written that long ago, different time in life, different moment historically, but also, like, you can keep it new in the process of playing things and let what we've learned in the interim affect how we're presenting the old stuff.
Do the songs change now that you've come back on stage and you're performing these older songs now? Are they always changing every time you tour them?
Yeah, I would say yes. I think everyone is much better at what they do. I think when we started, everyone was doing what they could. And I think now everyone is much, much better at what they do. And I don't know, I think taking such a long break, when you do come back to the songs, you're almost, it's this thing of where you're attached and detached at the same time, where you're not like swimming in them, so you can kind of be outside of them and see how you can play with them and be more free with them. I think part of playing them too is that, or playing with them too, is from show to show things can alter, sometimes on purpose. sometimes it's a confusion where everyone realizes, like, all we have to do is land. No one will know if we land.
And we as audience members are none the wiser. That's such a beautiful analogy too, swimming sort of outside of them instead of in them. You're still connected, you're still in the pool, but you're not right in that whirlwind, that center of it all.
That's definitely what it feels like. And it also, I think it's what keeps it fresh and exciting for us every night too.
Yeah. When you guys first landed in our ears and our hearts and our brains and definitely our feet, you were like nothing we'd heard before. For many, it was the sound of the future. So for your take five, I've asked you to pick five songs that are the future sounds from the past, the sounds of tomorrow, today. And your first choice is from an artist called Suzanne Villa. Who is Suzanne? I found nothing about her online.
Probably because you were supposed to be looking for a Suzanne Valley.
Oh, see, it was written in the file that I got as Suzanne Villa, and all I could find was a property manager on LinkedIn.
That's her.
I even searched the song title, nothing. Suzanne Valley, the yes. Mystery is solved. What would my angels have me do?
She is a singer and songwriter and poet from South Dakota, who spent a lot of time in California, and I know her through California friends. She's kind of a pen pal of mine. And this song is from an upcoming album that she has in the can. I have the vinyl for it. I just don't know when it's coming out, but I know this is the first song that's coming off of it. And I asked her permission to share it, and she said sure.
So this is literally a song from the future, not from the past. No one else has heard this yet except for you, and soon everyone who's listening.
Everyone who worked on the record also heard it.
Lost in a river of angels' wings. Why you can't find me. We often place music in a time or a scene. For you guys, though, how much does that matter? Do you think having that knowledge of time and place and scenes gives an anchor to the music that you're listening to?
I guess you can come to a piece of music through a scene that you've heard about. As I know, a lot of the music I liked when I was younger was coming from Seattle or the Pacific Northwest, and you know something's going on there, so you kind of like follow the popcorn trail and find out about a lot of bands who are also from there. But I love when you hear something and you have no idea where it came from at all. And then, you know, then you do a little bit of digging and you see what it's connected to and where it came from. But it is great when something lands on you and you connect with it instantly. It can be from, you know, forever ago or from 2 years ago, but without any context. That's some of my favorite music I've found that way.
And you also kind of find your community too, don't you? When you follow that rabbit hole and you're like, oh God, this is the sounds in my head, or this is where I want to reach towards, right? There's something about finding your people when you discover that.
Oh, definitely. Is it much more diffuse now? Because I remember when music is really stapling itself to your brain and forming your opinions and who you do want to be around. It was kind of a mixtape culture back then, or, you know, further in, you make mix CDs for people, but you kind of, or you go to shows and you find your community there. But now I think it's, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like the world is gravitating towards eclecticism. It seems like there's like a less seen allegiance, which I really appreciate. I like the trend of dissolving this idea of allegiance to genre or to scene, personally.
There's a little less snobbery involved as well, isn't there? It's a lot more of an open book.
Yeah, I mean, let's not pretend like the snobbery wasn't a survival mechanism at a certain point in time, though. Mm. I mean, like, if the only thing that you have over the jocks, etc., or that what we used to call jocks, I don't know, is like an eclectic occult knowledge of punk rock and new wave, then like, I mean, there's a reason why that snobbery
definitely
became a part of the whole thing. I'm happy that it's gone, but it was definitely useful.
Oh,
I'm
absolutely.
Not like it wasn't useful.
It was useful. It also useful in realizing when you had to jump ship. I remember when, as you put it, a jock who, you know, used to call my friends and I, who were, you know, we were so cool. We were so cool. But a jock who would make a point of telling us how cool we were came into school one day wearing it was a Nirvana shirt, and I just, like, we were you know, we didn't jump ship immediately, but we just knew like it was over. We knew it was totally over.
You'd reached the tipping point.
It was, yeah. It's too much. It's really tragic, actually. Yeah,
I missed so many things because of that, though. I jumped so many ships because someone, someone I didn't want to associate myself with was on that ship.
I didn't listen to the Wailers until I was in my 20s.
I was just about to say. I was just about to say.
Fucking shame. I can't believe that.
I was just about to say. Some, like, mouth-breathing, like, you know, knuckle-dragging football player or, like, you know, was the reason
Sports are great. We love sports.
Sports are so great. But yes, Bob Marley was almost entirely ruined for me. Rick, I mean, this is also like growing up in Pittsburgh in a suburb, but like was almost entirely everyone I knew who was super into Bob Marley. I was just like, you are why I'm going to leave this place.
You always come back though to Bob Marley, not to the place.
Bob Marley. Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I would be surprised if any jocks walked into any of your high schools with Pharoah Sanders on their shirts. We're going to go next to the spiritual jazz era, a trailblazing tenor sax player, composer, just an amazing human, and a piece of music that was recorded in 1969. This is a phenomenal composition. Tell me about Ezefo Zam, your next choice in your future sounds from the past.
I was raised on a really strict new American religion. But a lot of the freedom I had was cultural freedom. My parents listened to music, and my mother came from a family of musicians. They had us learn music, and we were allowed to draw and paint and everything. And they had a record collection, and a lot of the collection was Impulse records and some even more arcane or like smaller label stuff than that, even from that time period. And Pharoah Sanders' Karma was a record we listened to a lot when we were little. And that was my introduction to Pharoah Sanders. And sometime in the late 90s, there was a bunch of reissues, and the Strata East record, Ezefo Zam, was reissued on CD for the first time. And it's an amazing performance by an amazing group of musicians. I think it's an incredible, incredible recording.
Remember what you felt and just how you reacted when you first heard this piece of music?
I mean, I was accustomed to the general map of Pharoah and Coltrane's and such. But also, I mean, I think I heard this after doing psychedelics, whereas I had heard a lot of the other stuff when I was a little kid. And there's something that I can map a general psychedelic experience to the nature of the dynamics of these pieces, and where there is like a slow like blossoming of weirdness into something potentially fun, into something cacophonous and potentially like frightening, into a place that feels like home and understanding, and back again. And then out again, and then back again, and then out again for 28 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. It kind of, it's always walking that tightrope, isn't it? It pulls, feels like you're right on the edge, about to fall off, and then it pulls it back in and brings in the polyrhythms and the wailing sex, and it's discordant, and then it becomes beautiful, and then it falls away again and comes back. It's just this kind of breathing, heaving, chaotic, perfectly composed, wild 30 minutes. I can't believe you listened to this on psychedelics, Kip.
Oh, come on.
that turn towards spiritual jazz was happening at the same time as, you know, a whole bunch of social upheaval in America, but worldwide, really. We're talking about that idea of music and how it reflects the times, how it can be something that reaches ahead of what's happening right now. If an artist is reaching for something that's not right in front of them yet, is it also, in some ways, a piece of music that is the hope of what that future could be? That it is the freedom that Pharaoh was imagining?
I think that it's all in there. I think that part of an artist's job is to try to embrace something like the visionary and the world that you want. But I think that there's plenty of the chaos of that moment also in all of the work from that time, and the pain and the violence and the struggle. But also the utopic is the overarching vibration, and that I'm grateful for, and that's why it's not a bummer to listen to.
Pharaoh also had a great sense of grandeur in what he did, you know, as do TV on the radio, I'd argue. What does it feel like when you step into that space, when you're either on stage or in a recording studio and you're just building and building and creating this epic music? What does that actually physically feel like for you guys?
If being artists just means you have a vision, you know, it's just trying to manifest that vision, your vision of beauty or chaos or, and in the sense, kind of grandeur. And, you know, there are times where at least I feel like I have the illusion that I've achieved that, or at least my version of it. And, you know, it's fleeting, you know, but it's the satisfaction you get as an artist. Like, it's those moments, like any other, like in a relationship when you have a great conversation, you know, it's like these moments that just really, that resonate and make you come back, you know, to do this for your life. I think that is at least my experience. I don't know.
You're also a band, and similarly to Pharaoh, that collaborate with a lot of different people and also with a lot of different genres, and it feels like a perfect segue to head towards the wide and wild world of Sun City Girls. We're visiting their 1990 album, Torch of the Mystics. Just before we get into the song that you chose and your future sounds from the past, what kind of impact has this band had on you individually or on TV on the radio?
I would guess that, like anything that we ingest, it might have had some unconscious effect, but I wouldn't say it's like a North Star for TV on the radio or something. But I got turned on to them in the 90s in San Francisco. And that record in particular, Torch of the Mystics, it blew my mind. And I'd heard some other things that were more like scatological and or more trickstery from them, because they have a pretty, they made a lot of music, and a lot of it seemed like they were just trying to get kicked out of a studio or something. But it's like I did listen to a lot of like National Public Radio growing up. And there's a lot of like world music shows, and then like the popularity of, say, like no shade at all to these musicians. I think they're fucking incredible musicians. Paul Simon, David Byrne, Sting, all these people were like grabbing inspiration, we'll say, from world music in different ways. And a lot of great music, obviously. Like, there's a conversation about like who owns culture. It's an ongoing conversation, and critiques to talk about like cultural vulturism. And if you want to start a podcast with us about that, I think that we could get that rolling. But but also a lot of incredible music has come from the mix of ideas, like internationally. Something that happened when I listened to Sun City Girls is that they were like taking like direct Indonesian influences and South Asian influences in general into their music, coming from a very punk rock way, and like not looking for the thing that is going to get played in a Starbucks, but the kind of thing that you would presume was soundtracking, like a story about burning down the Starbucks or something. A story, a fiction. No one would ever do that. Mm-hmm. And that record jumps from sound to sound in a way that feels like their trickster selves their white Western selves, but also with a reverence and respect to the musics that they're handling and having influenced them. I think that the record top to bottom is fantastic, but this song in particular, I think, is one of my favorites.
Choose the flower from Torch of the Mystics?
Again, go back to my early 20s when I was experimenting with psychedelics. This record came out and was very, very on heavy rotation and with me and my roommates, and it made an impression. T-130 doesn't do, we don't do creepy, really. Not creepy. On purpose. Like,
No, not on purpose.
But if anything that I've contributed, if there's any creepiness in anything that I've contributed, and I don't mean like creepy like in a
like gross
Me Too way. I mean like in a like horror movie way.
Yeah.
Scary,
yeah. Yes. Then I would say that maybe that record is an influence for sure.
As musicians, as collaborators, you know, off the back of Sun City Girls, and I guess Alan Bishop, who was incredibly uncompromising in the way that he made music with Sun City Girls, how are you when you get into the studio? Because there's clearly a vision, but with the three of you and with strong feelings, when you get together, is it that same sort of uncompromising approach that you have to the music that you want to put on a record?
Uncompromising in terms of what we find beautiful, or what we're drawn to, or what, you know, what has resonance to us. I'm just thinking, like, in group dynamics, there has to be some compromise. If no one in a group ever compromises to anything, then it's not going to function very long. Mm. So I feel like we tend to gravitate towards what's, you know, whatever the Venn diagram, what we align on, and an allegiance to what makes us excited rather than to what makes some other kind of sense, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, when everyone brings demos in or starts messing around or whatever, it's a mess that you just keep refining until, you know, some things are a mess and you're just like, I don't know, that mutant's not going to make it. You got to put it in a glass case. And there's some other ones where you're just like, okay, you might win the dog show. So we're going to keep combing your hair, giving you treats until you can be over here with the rest of the nice dogs.
I'm getting great insight into the creative process. Well, it's been, you know, more than a decade since your last record. You've obviously been playing together for the last little while, having fun on stage. You're here in Australia doing the same. Has that reignited any feeling to make new music with TV on the Radio?
We're actually been talking about barricading the door of this studio and just like working for the next 2 weeks. We have a hostage, so we can get stuff.
My producer is your producer now, it seems. All right, I'll take that as a question mark.
We'll see. It feels really good now. So, I mean, it just feels really good. I see it as a potential thing.
Great. Sound like a politician absolutely dodging my question.
I just don't know. No, I mean, we don't know. We don't know.
We'll see.
Okay.
Future is unwritten.
Yeah.
Most of it.
Well, that's what we're talking about today. The future, the past, the present. Your next choice is actually very much rooted in the present, because this is an album that just came out this year, just over a month ago, a beautiful record by an Icelandic composer called Hilda Guðnadóttir. Before we get to the song, for anybody who doesn't know, can you tell me a little bit about Hilda? Because she's got serious game in composition, doesn't she?
Yeah, I believe that she's an award-winning composer.
Yeah.
I was introduced to her work through the film Tar, which is one of my favorite films of the past, of the history of cinema. I think it's so good. And the soundtrack is incredible. And that's how I first was hip to, I mean, I guess I had heard her work in other films, but that arrested me. And then when I saw that she had a new album out, I was excited to hear it.
This is her first album in a while too. She's been doing soundtracks for, well, scores for Tar, for Chernobyl, for the Joker film as well, the first one. But this is the first work in a little while where she's kind of crafting, you know, her own stories and not responding to someone else's story. You've chosen a beautiful moment from this record called Melody of Not Knowing. Why did you choose this one?
I felt like it was the single.
It kind of is, isn't it? It is. It's the single of this record.
The bop.
It's definitely radio length. It's like I wanted, you know, balance out the 28-minute Pharoah Sanders jam with something a little bit more concise.
This is the radio hit. Well, it's, you know, I also love that idea of picking, and I don't know if this is intentional. I think you just like this song, but you think about classical music and in, you know, the canon of music in Western music, it's one of the oldest genres, continuous genres that we have in Western music. But here we are talking about sounds of the future. So she's taking a genre that is several hundred years old, but creating something very, very new, very minimal. There's space in this. It still has all of that intensity of emotion that classical music has always had, but it feels very now, this composition. She's a very exciting composer, really beautiful stuff. I'm so glad that you chose it. Own music, you're up there on stage, you know, you're performing the songs of the last two decades. I know I sort of spoke to you about it before, but how does it feel? Where does your mind go? Or is it different every night or different every time you play over the last, you know, quarter century that you've been together?
I still have stage fright right before we go on, which I think is a good thing because it kind of sharpens you up a little bit. I feel like if I wasn't, I have a little bit of anxiety whenever I'm making anything because I'm just like, what am I doing? Like, who am I? Why am I doing this? But it just kind of, I think, helps sharpen you. And you're just like, I just don't, this is the benediction of this anxiety is just you being just like, I just don't want to fuck this up like at all. And I think, you know, once you go out, it turns into this very comfortable setup where you're like, I know this is one place I know what I do have to do. This is one place where I know, you know, the order of operations, and I know that we can be up here. We're very lucky to be able to create and to be able to see people responding to what we're doing on stage, to be able to lose ourselves on stage. I also think some of the best shows that I've had, and maybe we've had, like, I just don't remember them because they're, you're just kind of
in
not
the moment.
In the moment. You're not, yeah, you're like not there. I think some of the best things I've experienced, I just feel like I haven't been present for, and that's a real
such
gift.
A crazy paradox, but yeah, I think it's really true.
Oh.
Forever, 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 forever. Thank you so much for making time to Take Five. I really appreciate it. This is the final Take Five of the year too, so it's really special that you guys have been winding out. You're the Christmas party edition of the Take Five.
There we go.
So thank you for bringing the party favors, Kip, in particular. It's been really, really fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Your final pick. Oh, yeah, we are hitting the party. This is a wild song too. Panamanian American artist and DJ based in New York City. Jehovah's Princess is their name. They describe their sound as aggro dance, which means I'm just co-sign all the way. Aggro dance is such a great subgenre. How did you find this artist? And just tell us about exactly what they're doing on record and even live, if you've seen them live, because it's wild music.
Yeah. Her stage name caught my eye on social media a couple of years back. And I presume that someone was raised in the same unfortunate New American religion that I was raised in. And I wrote her, and then I never heard back. And I was like, okay, whatever. I'll keep an eye out, see if she's playing anywhere. But then earlier this year, she found the message and wrote me back. And we had coffee and we talked about music. And I listened to all of the stuff she had up. And we talked about the experience of growing up in a what some people call a cult. And I know that her work isn't all about that, but it's a lot about that and a lot about the anger that kind of system of control can take from you. The anger of what, as a woman, what that kind of system of control can take from you. And it's kind of typical in a way for people to leave that religion and kind of go like balls to the wall as far to the other extreme as they can, because that's what repression does. And I had a lot of that in my 20s when I first got out of it. Kind of like don't want to let it have the power to define everything about you. But I think that I know that a lot of the work she's doing is processing and deconstructing that bullshit magic spell that was put on her as a child. And this song is pretty screamy. I will also say that having seen her perform recently, she was generous enough to contribute a performance to a fundraising like review at a bar that me and my friends have a few months ago. She can sing really beautifully on as well, and a lot of her music, through a lot of the vocal processing and everything, you can still hear her beautiful voice coming through. She also is like a sensuality, sexuality forward performer, but there's like a palpable anger accompanying that sexuality, which is like pretty wild and powerful to see live. She's a pretty amazing performer. Yeah.
It sounds like she's smashing through a wall in this song.
Yeah.
I hear it one way, but I imagine you understanding where she's singing that from, that would affect you in a very different way.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak to, like, you know, that's my interpretation. I don't want to speak exactly for her. But she did name herself Jehovah's Princess.
She did. I think you're onto something. Yeah. It's an incredible song. I, much like Suzanne Valley, I'd never heard of this artist before. So thank you for topping and tailing these introductions and taking us on a beautiful, wild and psychedelic ride through the future sounds from the past. Tunde, Kip and Jaleel, have a ball in Australia for the next few days while you're here. And thank you so much for taking Five.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot. So yeah. Thanks for having us.
Jehovah's Princess. And what a wild ride through music and TV on the radio's future sounds from the past. God, I love that. Such a treat to have them Take Five and welcome them back to Australia as well. It's been a huge year on Take Five, so next week I want to celebrate some of my favourite moments with you. 5 of the best Take 5 bits across 2025, dropping here on the podcast next time. I'll see you then.
Hang out with your best music mates every day on Double J. We get you through weekdays with fun morning chats and tracks with Michael Hing, Karen Lang with your lunch soundtrack, and Dylan Lewis drives you home from 3 p.m. Get your Friday started right with Zan Rowe for Take 5 and Desco, and Howler to Kefu kicks off the party Friday night from 5. Plus, Yumi Steins and Kaz Tran keep you company all weekend. Great music and great company every day on Double J. On digital radio in your car or anywhere on the Triple J and ABC Listen apps.